Please sit down. Over there by the table. The twin stares moved away to the two chairs, found them, and returned to her. William had finished dressing and put some water up to heat for coffee. Marge? He looked boyish and a little lost. I'd better go fix the door, huh?
I think so.
Everything okay? She nodded, and he went past the judges on tiptoe as though his footfall, even unheard, might somehow offend. Because he had been offended, and he was angry too. Margaret saw it without knowing how. It wasn't in any action or expression, but it was there all the same. Anger and hurt pride, and with it all a desire deeper than momentary anger to be respected, seen as a man. She sighed. Her husband was a toughened, competent fighter who had learned a dozen kinds of patience, had passed through horrors and kept his mind whole, had endured the terrors of war and the pain of wounds, and yet, confronted with these scary Sunday guests in the best married students' quarters in town, he fell back into a boyish resentment and confusion. "We were sleeping late," Margaret said to her parents. "We had a late night last night." They sat still, their faces set. William came back with a hammer and some nails and a piece of board.
"Tell them we don't always lie around like this."
Margaret translated dutifully and they nodded. The words were betraying her again. The sign made it look as though he had meant not always, but often, usually. What happened to him? Abel's hands were tight.
Nothing. We're fine.
You told us he was going to the university.
He is.
College people do not live like this. We know. We have been to the college. This morning.
You don't understand, Margaret said. The problem is not money. It is that there are no places for married students, for all the people who are now able to go to college on the government's plan.
I don't like this place, Janice said, looking around. This place is too small, and you surely have mice here and roaches, too. College people don't live in places like this. The old stubbornness was hardening her face. Margaret noticed that she had put on weight in the last few months. It made her seem taller and more formidable. Janice's section had won 2 production pennants from the government. She saw a picture of her mother, still more of a stranger, on her little raised platform, scanning the workfloor relentlessly to catch the girl who was stealing thread, or slacking off, or spending too much time in the new lounge.
"He is lying to you," Janice said, "or you are lying to us because of him. This is a bad place."
She looked all around again, confirming with her supervisor's eye. William had turned from the half-fixed door to watch them. How intense they seemed. He turned to the work again, relieved for it.
"Don't you see," Margaret said, "things are this way for all the married students. Because of the war, there aren't any new houses. This is one of the best places, really."
She wanted to show them in some way that she and William both felt, wanted to feel that this was a starting place for them. Although who could be sure? Who could really be sure?
"You and Father weren't rich or successful when you began."
She had hoped to waken understanding, memory, communion. Hadn't they been poor and in the best possible way in the past? Wouldn't they remember that poverty now as a challenge through which they had come as conquerors? The force of Abel's rage was almost palpable in the tiny room. His hands hurled words so violently against the small space that her head rang.
"Do you compare yourselves to us? You are not like us. Never. Deafs in the bad school we went to, deaf and dumb, and not even can learn our own language in the school so that we learn nothing, and anyone can cheat us and take our money and make the court come against us. You are hearing. So is he, that lying, lazy pig who says he is a college man. Hearing. He hears everything. I tell you, you sit here in this cockroach house that is worse than any place we lived. How can you come away from our nice place, trees, your room, warm, everything nice, and live in this beggar place, and take money from the government like beggars, beggars!"
And he made that sign to her. Even Janice,
stony beside his rage, pulled in her breath. William, knowing that something awful was happening, was kept from action by his ignorance of what it was, and helpless in the silence, he watched his wife begin to weep. 17. Abel began to wonder if he was getting sick. For a time, it felt like a long time, the world seemed to lose the sharpness of its outlines for him. The life of the speaking, all the war news, his work, his travel to and from it, the faces of people passing on the street, his own house resting its weight on the little throne of lawn and shrubbery, became vague to him. Even church and the people of real existence, the deaf community, in whose respect he had always taken such pride, went into a kind of shadow, darkening, chilling, and becoming unreal even as he stood talking with them after church. Janice was more bitterly unhappy. She went over and over the visit they had made, blaming him for what Margaret had done. Blaming him also, he thought, for showing it all to her when they could have stayed home and been innocent and gone on receiving the bright, quick, lying letters from Margaret. At first, her anger was ugly and desperate, as though if he took the blame, she would be saved by it. Night after night, it went on until the attacks and defenses were habits and the anger was weary, dogged, and routine, like tired feet that still keep walking. Once he went to the minister to see if there was a way, some kind of medicine, law, wisdom, some special healing that was not for the pains of the body, but would ease Janice's anger. The minister spoke to her twice and failed. There was no one else, nothing for the deaf, although the minister said there were special doctors for such things among the hearing. In the end, Janice's anger became a habit among the others and took its place at its set time, and Abel found defense to it. Rumors were starting at church that the war was going to end tomorrow or next week. Prayers were said at every service, and Abel's wishes for its end moved guiltily among his fears of what would happen at work when the men came back and new machines came with them. Those men were heroes, and he was not a hero, but only a deaf man and getting older. He worried for Janice, who defended her position and herself to him every day, with more and more reasons why she would not be fired after the war. The union men were against her, and they had told her so. They had even sent an interpreter down to talk to her. "The union thinks that your ways are unsafe. They are not going to argue about changes now because of the war, but as soon as the war is over..." She had waved him away and then turned her face so as not to hear him. Ever since the days of home piecework, she had hated the union and had told all her friends at church that they were out to get the deaf. She had told Abel the union's words were only speaking gabble, but he thought of it often afterwards and worried for her. Who knew what they could do? Some complicated secret legal thing for which there was no weapon known to him. He had heard that in places like New York City and Washington, D.C., there were lawyers who could sign and who understood deaf people. What money would it take to get one of those lawyers? "No," he told Janice wearily. "If the union made trouble, it would be better not to fight. Let the thing happen and wait, and then try to creep in somewhere and make a place in some hidden or forgotten little fold. Deaf people who were noticed were lost. It was better not to be noticed." This led, as every thought must, to Margaret again, and Janice mounted the theme and rode him down upon it. If he had fought, Margaret would be home with them now. If he had stood against that college soldier, Margaret would not be having to live and believe in his lie this moment. College man. Of course, she didn't really believe William's lie. She knew and only thought it was easy to lie to them, to keep them deaf and dumb and out of the way. The time went on in shadow. They lived it with great caution, fearful of any change and peering at everything as though for the first time. Rumors about the war came and went again until no one listened to them anymore. And then very suddenly as it had begun, the war was over. Janice and Abel waited as they had waited for the invasion, and like the invasion, the great surprise was that no surprise came. At the mill, there was talk about some new thing. Janice didn't even try to make sense of the mouths anymore, and when they handed her notice of another change, she took it home only because she didn't want to throw it away at the plant or on the street. She showed it to Abel before she threw it away. "They are closing the spinning and weaving sections," he said. "It says here that they are closing that whole part." "How can that be? How can you sew without cloth?" "It says that USA cotton is less profitable, and now that foreign cloth will soon be coming, they are closing the two sections and will only make the clothes from ready-woven cloth." "That's trouble for the weaving girls, not for me." "What is strange is that they say that in order to close down, they have to expand." At the printing shop, orders increased and new machines were promised. All of a sudden, it seemed that everyone wanted color, all the color he could have. "The boss keeps giving me notes. Wide margins, lots of space, lots of color and contrast," he says, "like before the war." "Before the war. Everything, every day, they say, make it like before the war. It was paradise then." And he showed her heaven in a sign vast to burlesque, so that she laughed. "Hearing always dream," she went to put up coffee. "Hearing dream," he said to himself. "They tell themselves the dreams are true, but then they make a law and everyone believes in it, and it is true after all. And if you say, if anyone says it is a dream, they put him in the jail." She came back and shot a hard look at him, and his hands dropped. "I got another letter from her today."
"What does it say?"
"Nothing." The letters from the dreamer continued to come steadily once a month. They were always the same and always had bits of news about William which Abel didn't understand, and the evidence of which Janice tried not to believe. William's inorganic chemistry didn't prepare him for organic, really, and it's been a strain. William has passed his finals. William has a 3-point average this semester. Sometimes Abel looked at Janice over a letter and when she caught his eye said,
"Do you really think he is lying?"
She always said,
"Yes." "But you know he is really in the college, don't you? I mean, really."
"Yes, I know." "Then why do you say he is lying?"
"I don't know. I know he's lying, though."
"About what?"
"I don't know. He is, that's all."
And she wouldn't say any more. As far as they could tell, Margaret and William still lived in the awful cockroach house, which Margaret said had been fixed up during the vacation. Janice and Abel never answered the letters. Writing was a strange and artificial game to them. They did not try another visit. On birthdays and holidays, they sent a card, and by this, Margaret was to know that they were only waiting for her to take the blame. After the summer, another subject was introduced. "The government has finally decided that something has to be done, and the school is getting money to start building soon. I can't wait for the new married student bungalows. The need is getting urgent."
"What does that mean?"
"It means they are ashamed," Abel said. "That place shamed them, and they are admitting it now."
Janice thought it was saying something else, but she didn't know what. Hearing were never ashamed. "The government should hurry with that housing. The army is willing to give surplus Quonset huts, and there are barracks which are standing idle and could be moved."
Margaret wrote of overcrowding in all university towns because of returning soldiers, and praised William again for getting their place. In September, she mentioned that William had gone to the owners of the big house to see if an addition could be built onto it. Janice and Abel wondered why they would want to add anything to that disgusting shack. It was horrible that Margaret would write such a thing. It hinted at permanency and at accommodation to ugliness and poverty. For what had they worked? Why had they moved if not to raise her from it? Abel read the letter over, hoping that the periods or commas or one of the words was lying to him, and that given the proper way to read it, the words would come right. When he saw that there was no hope of this, he wrote to Margaret and told her to come home for a visit. After a delay, she answered.
It would have to be over a weekend, she said, and it should be soon. The week after next would be fine. She could take the 4 o'clock bus on Friday, and this would get her in at 5:30. She would have to leave on the Sunday morning bus, though, because the evening one would get her back too late to get ready for work on Monday. There were chores to do around the house. They would have Friday night, though, and all day Saturday, and she looked forward, she said, to seeing them. Abel was exultant. She had forgotten how wonderful the house was, how clean and airy her own room was, which she had left on a whim over a year ago. Now that she had agreed to come back, she would see all the things that she had left behind. She would no longer want to stay with that liar and warm his lie for him. For the whole week he had Janice running back and forth, cooking and cleaning and buying new curtains, until she began to protest that she would not be a servant in her own house. On that Friday, he took a suitcase to work so that he could change at the end of the day, and he got time off to be down at the depot for Margaret's bus. In his eagerness, he left too early and had to endure waiting at the depot in an impatience that was like pain. At last, the bus came. He saw the people begin to get off one by one, and then the driver got off and began to help someone down. He saw a pale face and shock of brown hair pulled back. It couldn't be. It was some older woman there, sick possibly, because of the way the driver helped her. He found himself sweating, staring at the bus, unable to go forward and find his child. Then he saw that it was she the busman was helping. It was Margaret. And there she stood, waiting for her suitcase, which was being handed out by someone. She was bare-legged, and his Margaret had always worn hose, of which she had been so very careful. She was standing strangely, with her feet a little apart, like the farm women he had known long ago, women who were used to carrying. She turned, and he saw her looking around for him. He stood up, but was unable to move, and she came toward him smiling, carrying her suitcase, and the big belly stuck out in front of her, pushing through the light coat which she had had to open. He was faint and sick, and he had to sit down because he was afraid of falling. When she was standing in front of him, he got up again quickly, so as not to have that terrible belly before him. As he looked at her, a pity for her rose in him, and at the same time, such a deadly hatred for William that he could scarcely contain it. Those two, William and Margaret together, had killed his daughter, his glowing, loving girl, and had given this stranger, this tall, cruel woman, her place and her name. "Are you glad to see me?" "Yes." He couldn't see himself make the sign because his eyes had tears in them. "Are we going?" She stopped, realizing that he couldn't see her sign clearly either. She had put the suitcase down, and after a minute he picked it up and they went out to the car line. It was light outside, springtime. He suddenly wished it was winter and dark now so that he wouldn't have to look at her. She said, "I'm happy," speaking quickly. Her purse bumped against her arm as she spoke. She was large now and clumsy. He shook his head. There was a terrible noise in his head, a beat like a great press running hard and slow, slowed down to 45 copies a minute, and each beat of the press made a pain behind his eyes. He was glad he was carrying the suitcase so he didn't have to speak to her. They got on the D car and took their transfers and moved to the back of the car. They sat side by side and stared outward blankly into the afternoon. Janice saw her daughter with no comment but a shake of the head. Her eyes had gone small as with too much light, and then she had blinked, shaken her head and motioned Margaret in, leaving her to stand in the mud mat place while Janice hurried away to set out the celebration. At supper she ate and drank and passed the platter to Abel and Margaret as though nothing had happened. Abel picked about at his food and ate almost none of it. Margaret, more disappointed and angry than if they had shouted at her, sat and stared from her plate to her father's. There was so much she had wanted to say to them and to be told. She knew they did not think her brave and resolute to go with William when his own doubts had been so great. This year in the miserable house had shown on her, not without awe, the measure of her tenacity. But she was pregnant now, and there were terrors in this which she could never tell William, because he would take them as a reproach. She had known that Janice would have no comfort for her, no pride in her strength. It was Abel on whom she had counted. In the kitchen after dinner, Janice was more at ease, and after a while she asked a few laconic questions.
When will the baby come?
In May.
You have things for it?
Some.
Are you going to have it in that place? She made the sign look obscene.
No, in the hospital. William was in the army, you know. There are certain benefits I can get as a dependent. They call it dependent of a serviceman.
You don't depend on him. You work, don't you?
I will quit next week. They don't like pregnant women teetering around at the bank. You have to quit when you get too big.
What do you live on? His government begging?
It is not.
And then Margaret sighed and gave a half shrug.
Yes, on that.
In the front room, she heard Abel slamming things around, and then he went upstairs, banging as hard as he could on each step and pounding on the banister. Upstairs, he went from room to room, kicking the doors open and slamming them shut in his futile quest for noise. Janice, aware of no more than a few vibrations from the shivering door frames, stood stolidly at the sink.
"Why is he so angry?" Margaret asked.
And Janice looked irritated and did not take her hands from the suds. They did the dishes and cleaned up the kitchen mechanically, and Margaret, humbled, said no more until they were finished and the last dish and cup put away. Then again, as they began to leave the kitchen,
"Why is he so angry?"
Janice shrugged and went on past Margaret, going widely with a cruel fastidiousness that would very purposely avoid the great belly. On Saturday, they allowed Margaret to make the excuse that she needed to shop for baby things. She didn't come home until late, and when she did come back, her face looked so drawn that they were both frightened.
"You all right? You look sick." "I am a little. Not sick, but sad. I went back,"
she started to say home, but changed the sign quickly.
"Back to Vandalia Street, where we used to live. I guess I wanted to say hello to some of the girls I went to school with. The store downstairs was empty. Mr. Petrakis died. He died last year and we didn't even know. The people at the store told me. I wanted to see him so much and he isn't there anymore. It made me so sad that I didn't know."
She couldn't tell them that her first emotion had been fear and not sorrow. Abel sat back relieved. He had felt ashamed of the way they treated Margaret, and even though it still sickened him to look at her so blatantly pregnant with that beggar's child, he knew it would be wrong to offer no help. You don't have to go and buy things at that pawn shop anymore. When it's time, you can get a new thing, a baby bed or what you need, and we will pay for it.
"I didn't want to buy anything just to see him."
"He was always dirty," Janice said. "The wrists of his shirts were always black with dirt."
"I wanted to tell him about William and the way things are and the GI Bill and what we are doing now and the baby. I wanted to show off about the baby and to tell him about how they've opened a laundromat near us, so now I won't have to haggle and fight over the washer at the big house that no one takes care of. I wanted to tell him..."
"You went all the way back there to talk about laundry?"
"He was always so nice to me. I wanted to write so many times, but it seemed strange without some special occasion, and working over Christmas there wasn't time."
She was beginning to cry, so she made an excuse and went up to her bedroom. The big advantage in being in that room in that house was not that it was lighter, prettier, or bigger than the room in which she and William lived, but that she might lie on the bed at night and sob aloud against all the need and the fear and the things lost to her, and not be held to account for it. With William sleeping beside her, there could only be the long, slow, silent grieving, which dare not even alter breath. She realized as she lay back and wailed that it was for this reason that she had come. In the living room, Janice and Abel sat facing each other, and it was Janice's turn for shock.
I worked and worked to keep them clean when they were children.
It was the first time she had spoken of Bradley, even indirectly, and for a moment Abel wasn't sure of her meaning. All the time they were growing up, I tried to separate them from the dirtiness and the poor people there. Margaret had a clean dress every day, not like the rest. And now, at the first thing, off falls the college ways, off comes the university, off comes the job at a bank, and back she goes to Vandalia Street, pregnant, a woman who has to pay her husband's house and food. Abel, numb, retreated into the newspaper. The newspaper had been an affectation at first, and a defense against having to stare at people on the bus. But since he had come to be a leader in the deaf community and someone to be consulted, he had come to know the few well-educated deaf in the city. People who spelled more than they signed, because their needs and knowledges exceeded the signs that were used for the basic things of living. More and more he felt himself needing to grow into these new words. How complicated they were. How minutely subtle the differences they could express. As he watched these deaf, he began to understand dimly some of the joy they felt in their arrival at the perfect meaning, the exact word, the shade of difference between discipline and punishment, between respectful and respectable. He had begun to try to read the newspaper, and later had even bought a dictionary by which he hoped to be made able to understand it. Janice had laughed at him and accused him of trying to make himself more than he was, and later of using his reading to close away her advice. Both of these things were true, but it was also true that over the years Abel's world had widened more than hers, and that now he knew a few of the two-world deaf, the rare, beautifully signing, well-educated deaf, who did not consider reading an activity for hearing alone. He began to wonder if he might be able to reach their worldliness. Nevertheless, although he did not admit it to Janice, the dictionary had been a mistake. It embarrassed him even while he blundered and stumbled over the words that were supposed to explain the other words. When he was through, the words had sieved all meaning and left him with nothing. Somewhere, somewhere it was hiding, and he was not quick enough. It escaped. This evening he was glad to be free of his house and vanish into the hunt. He settled back in his chair with that dictionary and the national news. Mr. Truman had made a statement about his position on an arms treaty. Abel sighed. Position. He had struggled with arms in the newspaper before. There were times, Mr. Walker from church had told him, that arms did not really mean arms, but guns and cannons, bombs, things that neither looked, worked, nor acted like arms, and were not part of a man's body. Nevertheless, treaty. The word was under treat and right under treatment. The act of treating or negotiating for the adjustment of differences. None of the words but treating and difference meant anything, and the S on the end of difference made him suspicious of it. The president was talking like a doctor about treating, so the arms must be body arms after all. Abel read to the end and found little to understand. The work done, he turned with relief to the local and sports news, and the story of a little girl who had fallen into the river and been pulled out by a heroic boy. The words were much simpler here, and the ideas were real to him. It was so good when people helped one another, when they could help and understand one another. He thought he would cut out this article and show it to the men at work. Sometimes he saw one man with a newspaper point out something to another as they sat eating lunch. The second man would nod and maybe smile, showing his appreciation of being included. Occasionally there would be arguments, no more than half serious, about something in the paper, and the men then began to motion at one another freely and happily, a gesture hearing could use that was sometimes vulgar sign. Yes, he decided he would take the paper in tomorrow and show it to the new man, Doran. Maybe something was the matter with President Truman's arms. The article had said position. That meant which way you were standing. Maybe his arms. It was better, the other article, the one about the little girl. At least he would not have to conquer his pride enough to ask. Who was there who would not laugh at him?
and he remembered with a sudden shock that Margaret was home. He had been so bereft at the loss of her and had put the thought of her help so far out of his mind that he had forgotten its possibility even when she was right upstairs. Margaret had never seen him with a newspaper. He had begun to feel this need since her leaving, and now he could go up to her room right away with President Truman's troubles and ask her to explain them. And also he could share the part about the little girl pulled out of the river. She would be proud of him and of his wish to join in the things that the whole world shared. His eyes lost the words he was trying to read and his mind drifted away. Only after a long time did something pull against a thought and snap his eyes back to the present world. Once, he could have gone to her and asked. But no more. She had never told him she was sorry for leaving them, or for denying all their years of work, or for giving them the terrible suffering of their uncomprehension as they stood in that horrible shack. Now she had come home, overwhelming in her pregnancy, and had made him feel more deaf and more mute than he had ever felt in his life. He put down the paper and was relieved to see that Janice had gone away. If he banged the doors again or stamped or broke things, Margaret would hear him and know what awful power she had over him. He felt so deaf that he stumbled into the banister when he went to go upstairs, up to his own safe room. 18. Margaret left early the next morning. Her parents didn't see her go, and they didn't talk any more about the visit. After a while, there was a letter from her that the baby had come. It was a boy, named Marshall. There was also something about plans to move, but Abel said it was only her lies to save William. He often forgot that William wasn't lying. Janice grumbled through the dozen false springs until warm weather, and then began to worry him about making another visit.
I want to see the baby.
It will be the same as it was before, only more crowded.
We have responsibility. It is not nice if we don't go.
Abel flipped a hand at her, but he was only pretending to be irritated. Whenever Janice talked about responsibility, it meant she did not want to do something, and could be told that the responsibility was too great. You got things for the baby, that's enough. You can send them in the mail, he said. Her face eased. And then they got a letter from the in-law, Mrs. Anglin, and they thought it was sent by mistake. The careful handwriting was full of congratulating words for them and insisted that they be happy and that they be proud.
This is for Margaret, this letter, Janice said. It's the mother and father that have all the shake hands and cigars.
Abel had a sudden, sharp memory of the box of cigars he had bought when Margaret was born not long ago. She is going there, his mother, Janice said, reading on. This Sunday. They stared at each other. Is she going so soon? Janice nodded. He could see her fear, the closing of her face against it. In the strange way of its spreading, he found he felt it too, a fear, and he hated being afraid. Janice said, I wonder if she goes up there all this time. No, he said, the fear growing in him. Margaret would tell us that.
Margaret, and she scowled. Margaret keeps secrets like any hearing, and they have the telephone to talk with and make their plans. I think that woman goes up there all the time and brings presents and sees that baby.
Well, he said, we have a right to go too when we want to.
I want to go on Sunday then, when she goes. This time I will write to Margaret and she will know we are coming. We are the grandparents more than his mother is.
Still, the fear. The day was measured with an exacting ceremonial equality. The baby was given gifts precisely timed and admired precisely, and they all went out for lunch, which Abel insisted on helping to pay for. Mrs. Anglin's brother, who had driven her to the university for the visit and had to be back early, offered the riders a ride in his car. They declined triumphantly. And Margaret let Mrs. Anglin hold the baby all the time they were riding to someplace William had insisted on showing them.
In the end, it turned out to be nothing but a flattened strip of land behind the backs of the university buildings, even behind a dump of cinders which had been mounded and washed down into banks and gullies over the years. The piece of land had been stripped of weeds and soil and stood raw and yellow ugly, wavering small fingers of heat in the afternoon sun.
"Buildings for the married students," Margaret explained.
Janice and Abel stood and looked and ventured nothing into Margaret's busy fingers. Even her sign was like a hearing now, full of unsaid things to make them afraid. She went on.
"They are going to bring in some army barracks and set them here, and they'll be painted and fixed up, and walls put in between the apartments, and each one will have its own door and at least one window on each end, and there will be regular heat and light and water."
She went on, full of excitement. Janice and Abel looked at the bare place stretching before them and back at the Anglins and back at the bare place again. Somehow, Margaret's words didn't seem so wild or false with Mrs. Anglin's eye moving over the scene, and her brother making some comment or asking a question now and then. William's own family treated him with smiling and respect. Even his uncle noted his words and didn't wave them aside. And to Margaret, who was only a beggar's wife carrying their water in buckets, they gave a deference which made Abel look at them in wonder. He tried to study William more carefully. In the long months of separation and the betrayal of their hopes, they had taken all of his remembered features and twisted them into uglinesses that could not now describe him. Here he stood open in the daylight before them. The pinched and bitter look of his early times with Margaret was gone. It was not possible now to remember him as a person who had known war and the pain of wounds. As they were leaving, Abel asked how long it was going to be before the new houses were made. William spoke, and Margaret told them that by summer they had been promised. Then William said something more, but Margaret did not translate. He still had the same closeness of mouth as his mother, and there was not one word that Abel could read. But Janice asked, insisting, until Margaret, embarrassed, told them what William had said.
"He said he will be relieved to get out of the trap we are in."
Then she went on herself, speaking in his defense. If they could only see what other married students had to do, if only they could know the persistence and steadiness it had taken. Abel nodded, but he was no longer really paying attention. That William at least knew that the place he had taken Margaret was miserable. It was some sign of hope. Before they left on the afternoon bus, Abel asked William his opinion of President Truman. Abel could not trace in his mind how that visit came to be made again, or how it grew into a monthly event. But it was they, he and Janice, and not the Anglins who arrived to help when Margaret and William moved into the veterans' housing, and it was they who brought the carriage and took Marshall for his first ride in it. After a while, Margaret asked them if they wouldn't stay with Marshall sometimes so that she and William could go out together. They were always careful to come back in plenty of time to take the riders to the bus and see them off. And once, as a Christmas treat, William and Margaret came into the city for the weekend and, dressed in their best, appeared at church on Saturday afternoon with Abel and Janice. There they gave Marshall to his grandfather to be paraded in his arms before the congregation. It was because of that visit that Abel was forced to try to talk to William. The people at church, even the few special ones, had been impressed with William and had made pleased comments about Margaret. "What was he studying in college?" they asked, and Abel could not answer. The next time the riders went for a visit, Abel made Margaret sit down with him as he greeted William. He wanted to hear from William and not from Margaret about the work that William hoped to do. It was something, they told him, called human engineering.
"How can you build people like bridges? Maybe you make those false people they have in the stores to be shown wearing clothes."
He didn't like to think about those false people. He had always felt uneasy looking at the bodiless feet and hands that some stores showed, put into the shoes and gloves they wished to sell. These cut-off stockinged legs and severed heads with lovely hair showed the hearing world at its most merciless and savage. Just for convenience,
for the single part that interested them, they would hack away the rest of a body as though nothing had importance but that shoe, that glove, that hat. Such things had to be built, no doubt. He shook his head. The young people began to explain. They blew huge mouthfuls of words, hands groping and spilling names and letters. Prosthetic engineering, visual field, eye-hand coordination. In the end, Abel had to be content with being told that it was a new trade, a whole new work where engineering and psychology met. And he was too embarrassed to tell Margaret and William that he did not know what psychology was. He nodded and smiled in the usual way, buying them silent with his smile and closing them away because they were a danger. Yet this time, he saw that if he really wished to know what they were trying to tell him, there might be ways by which he could come to it. This was a responsibility he had never known before. To learn would be a long search with no real reward at the end of it. Not to learn would be to remain mind deaf, and mind deaf by his own choice. For a moment then he wondered if hearing had such choices. But how could they? They heard. A person could not choose to be deaf. When Janice, bored by the talk, changed the subject, he felt relieved. That winter, suddenly, William graduated and the school was finished. Margaret told them that he was going to work for a company that seemed to Abel very much like the Cut-Off Head Company. William's company made legs and arms and eyes for people who had lost them. Margaret told him that the job was only temporary because as soon as they had enough money, William wanted to go back to school again. In school, not in school, engineer but not an engineer. Then she told him that they were going to leave for Chicago, and Abel almost fell, so stunned was he, so unable and unfit to ask the reason for it. They stayed a year in Chicago and then a year in California. They seemed to go like... He tried to picture with his hands the quick, bright, aimless, scattering way they went. Their way would be like a butterfly sign, if butterflies were made of wire and steel. Their ways would be like a butterfly sign if butterflies were eagles. And he laughed at the picture he had made in his mind. They had more freedom than eagles and less plan, those two, because eagles at least are bound to the laws of daylight and night and the commands of seasons. He found himself missing his daughter with a terrible yearning, as though she and William were dead and he would never see them again. From their high and terrible distance, they sent pictures of the stranger Marshall had become. A little boy. And then, when he and Janice had let them go forever and had made a fragile peace in loss, they came again, blown back by chance. William's work had changed. He was no longer making different arms and legs, but doing something Margaret explained, or tried to explain, as how much and how many. It seemed to be about the numbers of things a quality control worker could check at once, and what kind of things could be checked together. Oh, if the young people were like Eagle Butterfly, their trades were like the wind. Thank God, Abel said to Janice, that there are still people in the world who cause clothes to be sewn and books to be printed. Clothes and books can be seen and touched and used and thrown away, but his job is words, words and wind. It comes and goes, and no one ever sees anything of it. Janice shrugged. Marshall has gotten big, and he doesn't know me. I wonder how long they will stay. With a job like wind? I don't know. Abel frowned, uncomfortable with his comparison because he realized that a bird makes its home in the wind. But they did stay. Later, Abel found out that when William was still at his first job, he had made certain changes at the factory and had spoken once or twice at industrial conferences about what were called human factors in assembly line production. He had also been called in on consultations. In the 2 years he had been away, interest in his ideas had grown and other supervisors had had a chance to see what he had done. When he came back, he had called at the plants and found that people there were more ready for his services. Marshall was not a baby anymore. Soon he would be starting school, and Margaret had never had a real place to live. She never spoke of it, but Abel saw that there was something in her that longed for a house, a place, a neighborhood, and a few friends. The traveling had always been for better jobs. She had told him this herself. But friends at church said that any move meant a financial loss, at least in the beginning, and when he mentioned this to her, he could see that it was so. Margaret did not make friends easily. She was still enough of a deaf for that. Typically, when William made his decision to stay, he didn't tell Margaret until he was sure, and typically she agreed with neither eagerness nor argument. He was used to this quality of reserve in her. Some of his business friends' wives wrote her off as spiritless and flat, and it was a joke among them that getting Margaret to commit herself on whether she wanted to go to a movie or stay in and play cards was a study in futility. Sometimes William, too, was a little saddened by the lack of spontaneity in her. Margaret did what was right, and only once or twice, long afterward, did he realize that there must have been a price paid. Things could be different now. Margaret would realize that now there was time for preferences, for choices. He wished she could learn to be less afraid, to risk her wishes. She was so cautious when she approached any of his successes. It was annoying to stand against her cool approval, arguing, "But is that really what you want?" It did no good to remember how recently this acquiescence and reserve of hers had been her greatest strength, the virtue without which his recovery from the despair of war and his long, hard way through college would have been impossible. Only now... "It was fine," she said. "Fine." And he had to be content with that. They bought a small house in one of the raw new tracts west of the river. The earth had been stripped and skinned for the houses, and the dust rose from its dry wounds and danced in the driveways noon after glaring noon. Janice and Abel went to visit them there, but they were uncomfortable on the bare, raw patio and frightened of the continual flow of running dogs and strange children. Three or four times during the visit, curious neighbors walked in and had to be introduced, and the process by which they might be understood explained to them. Janice and Abel did not like the small, cramped house, the openness, the children, the raw ground, the dust, the loneliness that kept the neighborhood a continual flow from house to house, the mannerless intrusions and the gape mouths shouting at them with a silent force that made their heads ache. Margaret got into the habit of visiting them, taking Marshall with her when she went shopping on Saturdays in town. She would come in and talk for a while and then leave for the shopping, while Marshall stayed with his grandparents. They took him to church with them and bribed his boredom quiet with toys and candy. He was a bright, alert little boy, reckless, loving, and inquisitive. Margaret never failed to be astounded by his power over her parents. She had come by to pick him up one afternoon and, not seeing him waiting, had parked in front of the house and gone up the walk to call to him. Lying on the porch were two dead bodies. They lay ecstatically, grandly dead, draping their heads and arms over the porch furniture. "What are you doing?" But their eyes were closed, so they did not answer her. Around the corner of the house, face red with effort, eyes narrowed, head hunched, keeping low in the saddle, guns blazing in the hail of lead willy-nilly for the just and unjust, came Marshall Ryder Anglin, a sombrero on his head, rolled spurs and black boots and not a stitch of anything else on. He pounded up the stairs, alerting the waiting dead, and they gave him a fine long moment to enjoy the work of his hand before coming to life again. "Hello," both sheepishly seeing Margaret. "Where are his clothes?"
"We did not expect you so soon."
"Where are his clothes?"
"It was so hot, we were giving him a shower with the hose in the backyard. He wanted to shoot, so..."
Marshall always sulked when she came to take him away. When he was half sick with popcorn and candy, he sulked, and he sulked now as she held his clothes out to him. He had to take the boots and spurs off to get into his ordinary pants. The clothes were damp and dirty and stained. Ice cream. They had taken him out after church again and filled him full of ice cream and bought him everything he had pointed to. His stomach would be upset tonight and he wouldn't be able to eat his dinner at all.
She sighed. Come on, it will soon be dark. It's getting late.
We have to say goodbye, he muttered. We have to wave bye-bye to the Deafies.
Margaret's mouth went dry. But she didn't realize it until she tried to speak and found it impossible to make a sound. She had borne these very wounds as sudden and more bitter at the age of 5, 6, 7. Children bear great wounds with less consciousness and so more easily. Now she had trouble breathing, and she wanted to slap the insolent, innocent, pouting mouth. She had forgotten that she was capable of being hurt so deeply. Hurting and being hurt are childhood occupations. She had grown out of practice. Her hand trembled, but she did not slap him. Instead, she helped him into his clothes and, frozen-faced, carried the boots and 6 guns to the car. As they were driving home, she asked him, Where did you hear that word? The thing you called Grandpa and Grandma.
Oh, Deafies,
he said, maybe knowing that he had struck her again with it.
The ice cream man says it all the time, and the kids sometimes when we walk home.
Speaking very slowly and calmly, she tried to explain to him their difference. The words seemed sterile.
Don't people like Grandma and Grandpa? He asked.
She answered the rote by rote, the kind of answer that childcare books preach when children ask where babies come from. A kindly, humane, patient answer. Rootless and sterile. There was nothing to be said that he would understand. Because she was afraid of marking him as she had been marked, she was careful, book careful, and the words were purged of meaning. He went on with his questions in something like glee, although she tried not to think so, until she had to tell him to hush. The next Saturday, she debated taking him. He had learned some signs, which he used effortlessly, naturally, and unquestioningly with his grandparents. At the appearance of each new one, he had received such wild praise from them that he had come to use them a little like virtuoso pieces, for which an artist must be begged and cajoled. When he had used signs to the hearing, they had drawn no notice. What had any of this to do with the revelation of cruelty that he might see? She couldn't tell him about it. She couldn't even give any reason not to take him back to the grandparents who were so eager to die from his bullets. And so she took him and left him as usual and went off to the shopping. It was late when she came back, almost 6. Besides the grocery, she had done a good deal of bargain hunting around town, and the back of the car had boxes of towels and things for the bathroom, some fall things for herself, and the wardrobe of new clothes with which Marshall would be starting school. It was only kindergarten, and many of the mothers on the block didn't think it was worth the bother driving back and forth twice a day, just for finger painting and something the educators called socialization. They shook their heads, elaborate with pin curls, and put down their coffee cups.
Listen, who's got the time, right? With 2 other kids at home, I got more socialization than I can stand right now.
Margaret, comfortable only in the background, welcomed as a neighbor but too reserved to be a friend, felt an obscure guilt for her own opinions and her single child. She had wanted sometimes to tell someone how stunted she felt, how frightened for Marshall. William's work came and went, and he still had to work nights and weekends proving its value. Acceptance wasn't easy, and there were times when plans had been sabotaged by juniors who resented an outsider being called into the firm as consultant. Often when he was home, he was working on a plan and only half alive to his family. Marshall had been left to her, a stunted woman who could not open the world to him. She was humble and grateful to the teachers and the schools for seeing her lack and for understanding how deeply she wanted him to go beyond all the limitations with which she had had to make peace. He would be in school early from the very beginning, nurtured in all the ways of expression, comfortable with humor and tragedy, art, music. Deaf nowhere in any part of his mind. And yet there had to be these Saturdays also, and a shame to be born in him, perhaps for being with the Deafies. Was a person always to be divided by other people's needs? Lord, it was late. They would have to hurry to be home in time to start supper before William came. As she pulled up in front of the house, she noticed again how settled and peaceful it looked. Abel and Janice had taken good care of it. The porch and yard were scrupulously neat, the walk always swept. But it was the big trees that gave the house its feeling of strength and peace. They quieted the noise, softened the heat and glare of the day, blurred the hard lines of brick, stone, and wood. It was nice here. She felt like sitting a long time in the cool, listening to the sheltering sound of the leaves as they moved, and watching the slow lines of sunshine going rich against the afternoon shadow. The door of the house opened, and Margaret sighed and began to get out of the car. Marshall came out, and Janice and Abel followed him, smiling. The child stopped at the edge of the porch steps and turned to face them, his hands moving. He would be using it now, his mother thought, a new sign. As she walked around the car, she kept looking at the grandparents' faces, softened with love and glowing in the late light, and she saw the little boy begin to step back as a master does, to admire his work. One foot was out behind him, his weight thrown back, trusting for the floor where there was none, and the grandparents' eyes only on his face, his eager eyes, his hands working the new sign. Margaret found herself running, tearing up the walk and up the steps to catch him, screaming, "Bradley! Bradley, don't fall! Bradley, don't fall!" 19. Marshall had been born against Abel's and Janice's wishes. He had been taken away and returned at the whim of his father, whose strangeness they still feared. But never had any friend's lips or hands, no books or newspapers led them to imagine what blinding light he would carry with him into their house. They forgot that at first Margaret had brought him dutifully and automatically, and that they had kept watch over the privileged days only so that the other grandmother would not take more than her share. The little boy shone. He warmed the room. The simplest of his smiles tore at them with something like anguish, and he gave his joy and wonder to them with a total openness such as they had never known to exist. They soon learned to give him whatever he wanted. When he was hurt or denied, his sorrow could put a shadow against the sun. When Marshall was 7, the second child, Ellen, was born. Then he came to them dazed and shocked by the power of his own envy, and the Saturdays grew ripe and golden for them, staying home from church to bake cookies or to play his games until he was healed by them. He had never learned much sign. He seemed to be eased by their silence. It was a house without prohibitions or commands, yet Abel taught him to play checkers and gin rummy. And later, all of them remembered it and were puzzled at how it had been done by half-sign and gestures and half-read words. When he outgrew their total attention, they sometimes took him to church. There, he would fidget and stare, bored but not unhappy, waiting as they did for afterward and the short greeting with the minister and the friends to whom he was presented newly each time as though it were the first. They were modest as they brought him forward. A modesty in no way false. One is always humble in the presence of miracles. Sometimes in the evenings after he had gone, Janice and Abel would sit together and feel the creeping in of new fears to threaten their too obvious and abundant joy. The other one had means and a world to lure their grandchild away. She would soon be taking him to baseball games and picture shows and speaking to him in a grown-up way. When he was 10 and 11 and 12, he sometimes did go with his other grandmother on Sundays, and then Abel and Janice would work around the house in a nervous, restless haste, their minds full of pictures of him waving and laughing ecstatically. And for that moment, they would hate that other grandmother and all her matching bags and gloves and knowledge of the world. But Marshall always came back, and if they asked how he had liked the ball game or the museum trip, he would shrug and nod and offer no details, slipping down again on the couch with his comic books. Margaret and his father didn't like him to read them, and he kept a large stack of them under the living room couch in their house. It was a rare week that they didn't add one or two to the pile.
usually mystery or adventure ones, with many different flying and running men in fantastic clothes. They had stopped getting animal ones when he said those were too young. There was another baby, Matthew, and Marshall moved into the crowded junior high on Kirkwall Avenue, where there were fights almost daily for months. By that time, he had a bike, and he would ride over by himself on Saturday mornings, do an errand or two for Janice, and then sit down to draw or read or putter in the yard, or play idly, watching the day spread itself wide and then wind itself up before his eyes. The knowledge that he had come at no prompting but his own filled the grandparents with awe. They did not dare to ask him why he came for fear of spoiling it all. But once, as they sat prolonging the cold cuts and potato salad of one long, idle Saturday lunch, Abel wrote a note to Marshall. "Maybe hard leaving all good toy you get Christmas come here." Marshall shrugged, but then he took up the paper and wrote, "Ma makes me clean up all the time, so there's no time to play. She gets mad about stuff on the table or dirt on your hands. She's always cleaning or sewing up something that shows." And Abel ventured timorously from his fingers, "We are glad you like to come here." Again, Marshall answered with the paper, "Sometimes they all treat you like a bunch of doctors listening for your heart to have some kind of disease. It's nice where they don't test you and measure your faults all the time." Then they all sat back and did not talk. The boy ate and made patterns on the tablecloth with his fork, and the grandparents watched him, dumbstruck with pride and love, and waited for their hearts to slow. At the mill, Janice had been given a strange sort of death, a death only hearing could give, a death hiding in something else. When the retooling had been done and the expansion was over, she had been promoted to assistant manager of quality control. The job paid more and it was management, so the union would not be able to hurt her. But they had taken her away from the big room and the girls and the rows of machines. Instead, there was only a little room off the sewing floor, and she was only to be called when a piece came through inspection that showed one of the machines was faulty. Then she was supposed to trace down the machine from the girls' pile number and find out if the fault could be corrected by hand or if the machine needed to be seen by the repair team. At first, she had been proud of her new job. Day after day, she waited for someone to come to the doorway of the little room and beckon with a finger to call her to catastrophe, breakdown, the thread-stuck bobbin or the stitch drawn too loose, too tight, the sign of a girl using poor rhythm. For days and weeks, nothing came, and no one. When she had been on the floor, there were always arms being raised to wag for her to come. A new girl wondering why the bobbin bound. An old machine needing to be gentled back in a rhythm. Janice's own complete heartbreaking rhythm. Now she waited like a beggar at that door, hoping to be admitted to some crowded, busy place where in a time no one now remembered, she had been single, regal, and indispensable. After a month of anguish, she and Abel wrote a letter to the president of the company. The letter took them a week to write. Each word had to be selected with great care by newspaper and dictionary. In doubtful cases,